This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. The days trickle down to a precious few, as the old song says. 2017 is slipping away, but a lot has happened this year, you think? Three major hurricanes, wildfires in California, plans to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords, Saturn and Jupiter posed for their close-ups. And how about those colliding neutron stars and their gravitational waves? Bitcoin became a household name, along with blockchain technology. We're editing genes to save lives, and perhaps the event of the year, that total solar eclipse.
Whoa. Oh my gosh! That is unreal.
Yeah, you had to be there for that one, which I was. It was really some sight. We're going to review the highlights in the world of science, technology, medicine, nature. And joining me, an august panel of journalists who round up the news with us every week. Let me introduce them. Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo. Amy Nordrum, news editor for the IEEE Spectrum. Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. Welcome,
thanks
all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. We won't be taking calls today, but we already asked you to weigh in on your favorite science story of 2017. We'll be playing your thoughts throughout the hour. Let me begin that way. Let's take one thought from Grace in San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Grace Pan from San Francisco, and the science story that has meant the most to me in 2017 was on cracking the mystery of avian egg shape. It turns out, in general, the better the flyer a bird is, the more elliptical or asymmetrical the egg it lays. I personally grew up as an amateur birder, so for me, this has just been so satisfying and fascinating, and really encourages me to bird and to wonder about birds in a different way.
It's amazing what people get excited about with science story.
I think that's a fantastic story. I'm with her on that one.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about last year. It began with the discovery of gravitational waves. Then this year, we used them to learn something about the neutron stars, Rachel.
Yeah. It was a really exciting year for gravitational waves. To me, because the LIGO Observatory really became an observatory. Until last year, it was a detector. It was trying to detect gravitational waves, and now it detects them all the time. I think it had its third black hole merger announced in June. And then Virgo, which is another facility in Italy, came online, which was very exciting because with the two LIGO facilities and Virgo, they can triangulate, they can do all of this exciting stuff. And then a few months ago, they detected a neutron star, which is different from a black hole. It's this very dense thing. It only weighs a little bit more than our sun, but it is crammed into like 12 miles across, like the length of Manhattan. So just totally different from the behavior of matter that we think about on a day-to-day basis. And using these three gravitational wave detectors, they were able to find this neutron star, you know, look at it with more telescopes than have ever been pointed at anything, basically, and determine a bunch of cool things about neutron stars and what they are and what they do.
Ryan, were you are you impressed by that story?
Oh, my God. It was amazing. I think that, for me, just the discovery of where a lot of the heavy elements in our universe come from, you know, gold and
yeah, that was amazing.
Platinum,
yeah. And in fact, when we asked our listeners for their favorites, we got the most calls about this story, believe it or not. Here's Justin in Boise, Idaho, enthusing about colliding neutron stars.
My name's Justin. I'm from Boise, Idaho. The science story that mattered most to me this year was when scientists were able to detect two neutron stars colliding together through the use of gravitational wave detectors. Not only is this important because the gravitational wave detector won the Nobel Prize this year, but also because we were able to see it for the first time. So we were able to quantify what we were actually seeing, not through the use of gravitational waves, but through visible light, x-rays, things like that. And now we know where gold comes from, so that's cool too.
Yeah, I think that's probably got the most press of anything. That's where all that gold, they had a lot of gold they were talking about, right?
Yeah, I think the overall, the collision produced material that was 16 times more the mass of Earth itself. So it's just this gargantuan amount of material coming out of this collision. And the actual detection event, I believe, only lasted about 100 seconds. So you can learn just so much from these events once you've built these observatories and they're functioning as we'd hoped.
Ryan, when gravitational waves came up last year, everyone was celebrating the proof of something Einstein had long predicted. And we had another discovery like that this year, didn't we?
Yeah, and this one is interesting because it does use Einstein's theory of general relativity, but Einstein himself said, of course, there's no hope of observing this phenomenon directly, which is being able to measure the mass of an individual star using gravitational lensing. So the thing about gravity is that it changes the shape of space itself, and thus when, you know, a massive thing passes in front of a bright thing, it can actually shift the light and cause a sort of lensing effect. Now, scientists were actually able to measure the mass of white dwarf star Stein 2051b using this gravitational lensing effect and just a little bit of simple math, actually. So I thought it was pretty cool to do that.
So Einstein said this would happen. His theory said this would happen, but we could never prove it.
It was just, it was just such a specific and would require so much in the way of precision that he thought would just never happen. And again, no hope of observing it directly, but he was wrong by proving him right.
A long anticipated giant iceberg capped off in Antarctica. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I remember Larsen C. Yeah, so in Antarctica, this giant ice shelf broke off. It was bigger than Delaware, I think. And, you know, ice shelves break off in Antarctica all the time. They, you know, just kind of calve away. But people were really anticipating Larsen C because it was going to be a big one, and it was happening very quickly. It seems that these kinds of calving events are accelerated, unsurprisingly, due to global warming. You know, the water is warmer down there. The warmest period of the year is getting longer, so the time at which these ice shelves are really vulnerable is becoming, you know, more of the year. So it wasn't surprising that it broke off. And, you know, on the one hand, something like this breaking off doesn't immediately raise the sea level because it was already ice that was floating in the sea. You know, like having an ice cube in a glass of water, it was already there. But what it does is it leaves the ice that used to be, you know, within the Antarctic shelf then at the edge. So, you know, it means that now this is new ice that can break off and melt into the sea and raise it. So it's not great. And scientists are still kind of figuring out just how much climate change is accelerating these kinds of events.
And speaking of climate change, we had all these natural disasters, three major hurricanes. We have these wildfires that are still raging out of control in parts of the West. And can we draw any clear line between those, global warming?
Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people get very upset if they do not believe in climate change, if you connect hurricanes and things that we think of as natural. But hurricanes are definitely getting worse because of climate change. You know, climate change doesn't cause hurricanes, but hurricanes are fed by warm water. So if the ocean is warmer, a hurricane becomes more powerful. The other thing is that, as we saw a lot this year, storm surges are really the thing you have to worry about as a cause of death during a hurricane. So that's when the sea level rises enough to flood an area. And if the sea level is already higher because of climate change, which it is, then storm surges are going to be worse. So they're very quantifiable ways that climate change is making these so-called natural disasters worse, even if it's not causing them.
Amy, you're nodding your head about that.
Yeah, even the amount of water that the air can hold increases with the temperature of the air itself. And there have been some analyses that have now started to come out toward the end of the year about Hurricane Harvey in particular. That was the hurricane level 4 that hit Houston. And a couple of different analyses were trying to measure, you know, what's the difference in the amount of rainfall, because Houston was absolutely inundated with rainfall during those couple of days. You know, what's the difference in the amount of rainfall in this hurricane than we would have expected from a hurricane if the climate were not warming in the way that we know it to be? And the analyses have shown that there's 15% to 38% higher rainfall, which was much higher than even scientists expected in that storm as a result of climate change.
Yeah, it's been quite a year for the climate in general, but also the way climate is treated politically.
Yes, I mean, it's been interesting to see some of these natural disasters. I mean, there have been deaths attributed to all of these storms, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Harvey. throughout the United States. I mean, it's the wildfires in California, very dramatic damage happening there. And yet there does seem to be this disconnect. I mean, the amount of public funding available for scientific research, some of the very basic research that happens at the National Institutes of Health, for example, has been, you know, jeopardized by the new administration.
Yeah, and if, I mean, there were the March for Sciences this year. I mean, scientists really got organized in a big way this year, in a way that we might not have seen in quite a long time, you know, really rallying behind these issues and ensuring that they continue to get, you know, the funding and the support from the public that they need in order to do their jobs.
In fact, the interaction of politics and science upset quite a few of our listeners who called in about the Paris Climate Accord. Here's one.
Ira, it's Chad McCormick in Park City, Utah. Biggest science story to me this year was Trump administration dropping out of the Paris Climate Accord. I think in years ahead when the catastrophe potentially could happen, this could be the story and this could be the pivotal moment.
Have we resolved any arguments about whether the political activism is appropriate or a healthy role for scientists? I mean,
the thing that I think sticks out to me is the idea that while science shouldn't be partisan, it is absolutely political because it should inform policy. So to me, seeing scientists get activated, you know, and start to really insist that the government listen to basic reason and fact is really important. And I don't think it should be controversial at all. But I know that there are people who disagree.
Well, there's a good precedent. Scientists have, for generations, been active about it. You know, you can point to Einstein, sending a letter to Roosevelt.
Yeah, I'll say, too, I mean, in the technology sector, we've actually seen a lot of major tech companies take on what they see as fundamental workforce issues that are highly political issues. So this includes immigration, access to visas for their skilled workers, the people that they need to create the products and services that we use. And I think this year, more than in years past, we've actually seen these companies like Apple and Google and Facebook start to step up and speak out on these issues that people may not have expected to hear from them on as well.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, more of the top science stories from 2017, brought to you by our nerdy trifecta. Ryan Mandelbaum, Amy Nordrum, Rachel Feltman. We're not taking your calls, but you can leave us a message on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's the Science Friday Year in Review. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's our 2017 Year in Review. And we're talking everything from colliding neutron stars to Bitcoin. What a year it's had. We'll get into that a little bit. And we asked all of you to call in with your favorite stories, and you did not disappoint. Boy, did we get calls. Like this one from Florida.
Hi, Ira. My name is Abby DuBose from Pensacola, Florida. And I have to say, I love the science story when you were interviewing the two spider experts. I learned more about spiders and got all excited about spiders and decided that I think they're really cool to have around the house, and it's okay if a few of them get inside because they do great jobs. Thank you for your work. Bye-bye.
Here to talk more about the stories that stood out to them this year are my guests, Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo, Amy Nordrum, news editor for the IEEE Spectrum, Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. And Rachel, one of our favorite stories of the year was sort of bittersweet. It was the end of the Cassini mission.
Yes.
To Saturn. Did you have a little twinge?
I had more than a little twinge. I was very upset. I think a lot of people had a lot of strong feelings about Cassini. From a practical standpoint, it was just a fantastic mission. We got tons of amazing data. It, you know, outlived its lifespan. It taught us about, you know, not just Saturn, but the moons around it, some of which we may soon be visiting to look for life.
Yeah.
While it is very sad that, you know, Cassini's gone, it's amazing what kind of data they're still getting and still analyzing from it. I mean, just recently, there were new results that actually showed that the shadow of Saturn's rings affected the charges, sort of the particles in its ionosphere. So there's still some cool Cassini stuff. You know, it's sort of got its swan song now.
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, having the robot itself perish, obviously, you know, a little tough for people, but it's true that, you know, there are scientists who are now well into their careers who have spent their whole careers on Cassini and could easily spend the rest of their careers on data from Cassini. So it's true that the story isn't over. We just had to say goodbye to the actual spacecraft.
In fact, Cassini hit home for a lot of folks, like Rosalie, who called in.
Hi, I'm Rosalie, and I'm 8 years old. And I live in Benicia, PA. And my favorite science moment was the final moments of Cassini. I was really happy to watch it on my mom's laptop while I got ready for school. And I want to become a scientist when I grow up. And I was just so amazed. It was just so amazing to see the final moments of a real space drone circling and orbiting Saturn, my favorite planet. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Okay, thank you for calling, Rosalie. I mean...
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
I like she called it a space drone.
Yeah. My background on my computer is Saturn now because of how beautiful some of those pictures were. So I totally get it.
And I think sort of a sad coded to all of this is that we don't really have any missions coming up, like the Cassini mission.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nothing like Cassini. It's true. There are robots out there who are still collecting data. New Horizons is going to be visiting its next target almost exactly 2 years from now? A year from now. It's going to be like New Year's Day 2019. I've already forgotten what year it is.
And we also have those rovers, 14 years.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
A three-month tour, you know, and it's 14 years.
Yeah, when opportunity dies, I'm not going to be okay. The Mars rovers are definitely starting to show their age. You know, we don't really have any banner probes like Cassini coming for a while. We do have the Europa probe that's maybe going to launch in 2020, so that will be pretty exciting, but not landing on the surface until I think they're talking about maybe a mission in 2031. So it's true that after like Rosetta and New Horizons and Dawn and Cassini's finale, we had a really busy couple of years, and now it's going to be a little slower.
Well, we're certainly closer to home, seeing a lot of movement and progress on being able to image our own Earth more accurately and more frequently. So we're seeing a lot of kind of low Earth orbit and near Earth orbit satellites being launched by companies as well. So that's a positive. And I think, you know, as satellites get, you know, smaller and cheaper to launch, we're going to continue to see that as well.
And talking about the moon, continuing to talk about that for a moment, I think I would rate this as the biggest event, you know, national event of the year was the total solar eclipse. And Leanne thought the eclipse was the best thing she experienced all year.
I think the coolest science story of the year was the eclipse. It was beyond beautiful. I love how it brought the entire planet together. All the people, all the photographs, all the science behind the eclipse, all the science experiments going on that had to do with the eclipse, and that so many people got to enjoy it was just absolutely phenomenal.
Brian, did you go?
I did. Yeah, yeah. I was in Nashville for the eclipse. Unfortunately, I was there outside. It was a beautiful day. And then at 1:20, you know, just before, or I guess like 1:15, right before totality, a big cloud went right in front of the sun.
No.
You know, I still saw it. It was incredible. You can see the 360 sunset, and all of the animals started to, you know, act as if the sun was going down. So it was a really incredible experience otherwise. But I'm looking forward to the next one because I'm going to go to the next one too.
You're going to go to the next one here or the one that you can see in South America?
I don't know if I have South America money, but the next one here.
Rachel, you went to the eclipse?
Yeah, and I wasn't going to. I hadn't made plans. And then, you know, my boyfriend had friends in St. Louis, and we were like, okay, I guess we'll just go, even though the viewing conditions aren't supposed to be great in St. Louis. And we could, I think the most totality we could get was like barely a minute, but it was amazing. And it ended up being perfect. We had perfect view of the eclipse. I'd never seen a total eclipse before. And I did not expect it to be as amazing as it was. And I definitely, like, I'm an eclipse chaser now. It's what I do. And I need to go to another one.
Yeah, you get hooked. This was my first total solar eclipse also. And it was like in a movie. It was exactly like people said it would be. And it was like, you know, suddenly the sun is there. It's at 99%. And then when it gets to 100, totality, it's like somebody changed the slide. You know, new slide. Oh, and whoa, it just popped out. And that was sort of. Amy, let's talk about something really hot that ended spiking up this year, and that is the Bitcoin. Do you understand what a Bitcoin is? We've talked about this. We tried to get. Give us in a nutshell what a Bitcoin is.
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny because it really came back in a big way this year. I think most people, if they had heard of Bitcoin before 2017, it maybe would have been back when it very first launched, like almost a decade ago. But this year, all of a sudden, it was back in the spotlight. This cryptocurrency, so a virtual currency that you can trade and spend, much like you can, you know, your U.S. dollars or other currency that you might have in your pocket. It's all built on this interesting data architecture, this thing called the blockchain, which is also really heating up in 2017. And that's largely or arguably part of the reason that Bitcoin itself has gotten so much attention as well, as the overall blockchain that it's built on is really starting to go mainstream or almost mainstream. And this blockchain is basically a list of transactions that's shared between many different kinds of people on their computers rather than controlled by, you know, a central authority like a bank. And the way that the transactions, the list of transactions is updated is through these algorithms that all these computers do at once in order to keep it more or less hack-proof.
Yeah.
And there's been so much speculation all year about what is Bitcoin going to do next. And then all these other cryptocurrencies like Ether, Litecoin, you know, they're also kind of in the same situation where we could see them go up. Like beginning of the year, Bitcoin was under $1,000. By October, it had hit $5,000. And everyone wants to know where it's going to go next. And it's really kind of a fool's game to try to guess. But of course, that's, you know, that's the big question.
But blockchain, which Bitcoin is based on, is big, right? That whole, technologies, banks, MasterCard, people like anybody who handles money.
Absolutely. Really, the best way to think about it is actually as a platform rather than a currency. I think that's the way that most people will probably end up using it. And I understand that that's even more confusing to state it that way. But ultimately, you're seeing a lot of big companies get serious about investing in blockchain developers. They are hiring blockchain consultants.
Yeah.
There's like this entire mini economy now running on helping major companies get in on blockchain technology because it can do things like automatically execute contracts.
Right.
It can organize data in interesting ways. It can make trades and exchange of information easier using the cryptocurrencies as a kind of tool to get that done.
This is how I know it's important because I hear people on the subway talking about it.
I think that's really
the sign.
Absolutely. It's kind of hit mainstream. I mean, one of the apps that you can use to trade Bitcoin has gotten to the top of the Apple Store this year because people have gotten so into trading it. And it's obviously as an investment, it's still a very risky proposition for the average person.
Speaking of risky, here's one that I quite can't wrap my head around, something we've talked about. Ryan, and maybe you can help me. And we're talking about the quantum computers. Are they finally ready for prime time?
So a quantum computer is essentially a machine that can do computations with the rules of quantum mechanics in mind. A regular computer is built on the architecture of bits, which is essentially there's, you know, billions of zeros and ones that do the calculations, whereas a quantum computer is a system that can do those calculations with zeros and ones simultaneously using the idea of quantum superposition, quantum entanglement, and quantum interference. So now, I would say that this has been a really big year in quantum computing. There have been a number of different architectures that can actually be these qubits, can actually do this, you know, the superposition. However, that doesn't mean that we're at a place where a quantum computer can beat a regular computer, you know, at its own job.
Right,
but
right.
I think that this year's been a big one. Next year, we're going to probably hear some really big quantum computing stories from maybe Google, IBM. There's a couple of other smaller companies that are coming up now. But it'll probably be, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years before businesses are really starting to use it. And then maybe 20 to 30 years before you're seeing some of the biggest concerns, which are like breaking public key encryption that a lot of people are talking about.
Amy, I know you follow it.
The key phrase to listen to in future coverage will be the point of quantum supremacy, which is what all these companies, including Google and IBM and Intel, have been trying to kind of inch closer toward.
Quantum supremacy.
I know,
it sounds
like Star
Wars.
quantum advantage is the one that I like. But, all right.
We can debate our quantum terms here, but basically it means that that they've been able to demonstrate that a quantum computer can actually perform tasks better than a classic computer, and we're still kind of not at that point, but getting closer. And that's what all these major companies are interested in as they build these, you know, 49-qubit systems and 50-qubit simulators.
I guess if you talk about quantum computers, you can be right and wrong at the same time. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the year in review with my guests, Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo, Amy Nordstrom, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum, Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. They've been here all year talking about their stuff, and we're going to review some more of it. And let me move on, Rachel, to health research. We saw some big advances for gene and immunotherapies, didn't we?
Yeah. There were a couple stories that really stood out to me that both really came out in the latter half of the year. So people started talking about CAR-T, which finally got FDA approval. And it's an immunotherapy that basically takes patients' T cells, removes them, then doctors, scientists engineer them to have these certain antigen receptors. Then they reinfuse them into a patient's body. And those T cells are then basically programmed to fight off a specific kind of cancer cell in a way that normal T cells just can't do. And it's still, you know, it's a last-ditch treatment for this very specific kind of leukemia that mostly affects children. But it has successfully treated a few kids. And in theory, it works for life. You know, there was one of the studies that helped to get FDA approval. They infused a ton of T cells. I don't remember if it was 10,000 or 100,000 or in the millions, but a lot of T cells. And it took about a month for it to start working. And then suddenly it worked. And when they kind of trace back the, you know, genetic lineage of the T cells that were now propagated in the body, it had just been one of the engineered T cells that survived. But it had just replicated so prolifically that it had put this child into remission. Another couple of studies came out about using it in, I want to say, a kind of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, definitely a kind of lymphoma, again, for patients with no other options. And it showed that it can work really well, but it can also not work at all, and it can also cause a huge cytokine reaction that is life-threatening for the patient.
That's the downside of this thing, right?
When you amp up the immune response, that can obviously cause a fatal immune response. You know, our immune systems are totally capable of killing us, and they do frequently. So it's not exactly ready to replace chemotherapy and radiation, but it is really promising.
Yeah, and we don't need to use CRISPR for this.
No, and, you know, there is some research. Some researchers think that CRISPR could be a faster, easier way to accomplish this kind of gene therapy. But, you know, CRISPR's error rate is still pretty high. It's a tool that in theory is way faster and cheaper than all other gene editing, but there are a lot of bugs to work out.
Yeah, and there was just a story right at the end of the year coming out about CRISPR, a new kind of CRISPR being able to not have to cut the DNA, get it to express itself without actually having to cut it up.
Yeah, no, I mean, it has definitely been an exciting year for CRISPR as well. But I think, you know, a lot of people working on immunotherapy are, you know, not quite ready to factor CRISPR into it yet. There was another really cool immunotherapy story, actually, where this child with a genetic condition that basically makes your skin really susceptible to infection and abrasion. He was close to death. And they did something they've done on small patches of skin before, where they basically took skin cells, genetically engineered them to be free of this condition, and then basically did a skin graft using those engineered skin cells. And they did it on 80% of his body to replace all of the affected skin, and it worked. So that skin is just new, healthy skin now, and it's his own, so there's not a fear of rejection. You know, we'll have to see if it works as well as it seems to have worked. But, you know, it was one of those, like, moments where therapy really seems to be groundbreaking and kind of miraculous, which is so rare in the biomedical world, that was a really cool story to me.
Great way to lead us into the break. We're going to take a break, and after the break, we're going to come back with more stories from the 2017 highlight reel, plus some of our favorite Science Friday guests from that year. And if you're curious about the stories and projects that caught the fancy of the Sci-Fry team, some of them weighty, some of them just plain fun, you can see our office's 2017 Hall of Fame on our website. Visit sciencefriday.com/staffpicks. See what we like in the office on sciencefriday.com/staffpicks. We'll be back after the break with Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo, Amy Nordstrom, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum, Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. It's the Science Friday Year in Review. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, we're talking this hour about the top science stories from 2017. We've asked you to tell us what yours were, and here's a listener.
Hi, this is Jason Prawl from Houston, Texas. Definitely the story that hit me the hardest was that they've redefined the kilogram in terms of actual fundamental constants and not just an arbitrary agreed-upon amount. When I started out as a physics major, it had really bothered me that things like time and length were clearly defined based on universal constants, but mass was just something we had agreed upon. But as of this year, that has been finally resolved.
Yeah, a lot of people were happy for that one. And before we go back to the stories, we want to throw out our own nod to the hundreds, hundreds of scientists and other experts who joined us on the air this year. We could name you all right now. We would, but instead hear something a little more creative, a short selection of favorite moments from 2017. Behind the scenes of all this is Carla Dove, a forensic ornithologist and program manager of the Feather Identification Lab at the Smithsonian here in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before everybody does it, let me ask you about...
Yes, that's my name.
You know, my mom gave me this age-inappropriate, non-OSHA certified chemistry set back in the day when you can have things that blow up, you know. And I mixed these two chemicals together. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, I created this explosion. I burned her carpet. She ran in the room, and, you know, I got a spanking. But my brain was activated to science because I was a scientist at that point. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I became a chemistry major in college because of that one experiential moment in my life.
They have a siphon, which is kind of like a sniffer, a nose.
Right.
So they can smell if there's prey in the water. If they think there's game to be had, then they'll let out their proboscis, which is like a tongue. On the tip of the tongue is a harpoon, which they'll then inject into the fish, and then they open their mouth, the rostrum, really wide and swallow and engulf the whole thing. So it's not dead, but it's paralyzed. It's going into what we call excitotic shock sometimes, and then it gets swallowed whole. It's like the worst death you could imagine. There's no escape.
Gosh.
It's much easier to find dinosaur bone than it is to find fossilized species. When you think about it, a dinosaur only died once, so it only produced one skeleton. On the other hand, it defecated a gazillion times during its lifetime. And yet, because of the difficulties of fossilizing the soft materials, it can be very rare, and it's also very difficult to recognize.
And I think what happens is that they try at different locations. Maybe one ant says, let's start something here, and he'll basically send out some pheromones and gather two ants, which will gather four ants, and eventually get a couple thousand. And they'll try to build on sort of the flat edges of the container, kind of like a wall. But the problem is there's just not enough places they can get support. So they really sort of build and build, and it might get into something like 10 ants tall by literally the ants piling themselves on top of each other. But then the whole thing will just... it just kind of flops over.
I think one reason that many people have put off math is that they think they don't understand it. But none of us really understands it, honestly. We're just trying to understand it more all the time. And being confused doesn't mean that we're not good at it. Mm. I think a lot of people are put off because they feel confused and they go, oh, I'm no good at math. But actually being confused and caring about it is what matters. Often the people who think they understand it, they really don't.
I think probably science became a political issue when the discussion was, should we carry fire with us or not when we travel? I think that any time you have a group of people who are making decisions about how we use nature, that's a political decision. It's a human activity, politics, as is science. And so as we have gotten more complex, of course, the arguments get more complex.
How do we figure out how to have computers understand our human goals? This is incredibly important. If you take a future self-driving car and tell it to drive you to JFK as fast as possible, and you show up covered in vomit and chased by helicopters, and you say, no, that's not what I asked for, and the car replies, that's exactly what you asked for, then you've really just illustrated why it is so hard to have computers understand what we really want.
There is so much that is unknown in this field. But I do believe that just as Craig Venter and David Cohen suggested that whereas the 20th century had been the century of physics with all of these fantastic breakthroughs and achievements. The 21st century was going to be the century of biology, and of course they were talking about genomics. I think actually the 21st century is going to be the century of biology on Earth and beyond. I think there is a real opportunity in this coming century to discover life beyond Earth.
How many of those voices could you recognize? I'll tell you who was on there. Carla Dove, Leland Melvin, Mandy Hulford, Karen Chin, David Hu, Eugenia Cheng, Lydia Viacamarov, Max Tegmark, and Jill Tarter. Wound up with that last comment. And thanks to all of them and our great guests who joined us in 2017. And thanks to our producer, Katie Heiler, who put that montage together. I want to bring back our expert panel to wrap up our review of 2017. What will go down as the stories that we should remember from this year? Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo, Amy Nordrum, news editor for IEEE Spectrum, and Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. And Ryan, let me begin the final discussion with, I know, you know, you've been following CERN, the news out of CERN this year, and while some people have been down on particle physics, you think there's some promising news. Tell us why.
So I know that I think people have really had their eye on supersymmetry this year, and they're really worried that they won't find it. But one of the experiments people don't talk about quite as much, LHCb, has had some really interesting results this year. No five sigma discoveries yet, but there are a couple in like the 2 to 2.5 sigma range sort of bumps that are coming from the decay of a particle called the B meson particle. And people don't know. There might be another particle there. And then LHCb also discovered a new baryon, which is an arrangement of three quarks. But this baryon was really special. It's called the Xi double charm, double charged. It's pretty awesome.
Tell me why. Now, why is it awesome? When you say that, why is, you know, people say, wow, that's a nice technical term. But you seem to be into it, as we used to say.
I just saw so much cool theory papers that came out of this one particle because it had two really heavy quarks in it. You know, your protons, they have just light quarks, the ups and the down quarks. Same thing with neutrons. But this just really wacky particle, some of the theories that came out of it was perhaps there could be some sort of quark fusion, the way that we have fusion with hydrogen, or maybe there are these particles with four quarks called tetraquarks. I mean, just this one particle got a lot of theorists really thinking a lot. So keep your eyes on LHCb next year. They might have some cool results out.
Are we going to get any closer to them finding a dark matter particle?
So that's a little different. As far as dark matter goes, you may have heard that we're looking right now for a particle called the Weakly Interacting Massive Particle, or WIMP. And the idea behind a WIMP is that it's sort of in this Goldilocks mass that people think they'd find it, but they have these huge vats of liquid xenon underground that have yet to actually find one of these WIMP particles. They are just releasing their first results, so we're not really there to make a conclusion yet, but next year people might be a little concerned, so they are looking for some other potential options like strongly interacting massive particles, or SIMPs.
Ooh. Amy, you, what do you think? Is this just hopeful?
I mean, they're really exciting experiments. I think we really haven't been able to ask or try to answer these questions in this way ever before. So I'm just kind of looking forward to the results and hearing more in the coming year.
Rachel, is it always 20 years away?
I mean, you know, I think it's like reasonable to hope that dark matter will get figured out in the next lifetime. I think guessing more specifically than that is probably a little foolhardy at this point. There are a lot of like irons in the fire that could work, but nothing that's like, oh yeah, it's 5 years away.
Dark energy? Should we just forget about dark energy? We're gonna figure that out.
I mean, the universe is expanding, and the expansion of the universe is accelerating. So we have to figure that out because, as you know, right now it looks like 70-something% of the universe's mass energy is just weird. Like we're not there yet with dark energy. We know what's happening, and we're still trying to figure all these things out, and a lot of physicists are thinking about it, but it's unlikely that somebody's going to just have one eureka moment with one paper that ties
it all
together.
They do say maybe we need new physics, whatever that means.
Well, you know that Einstein's theory of general relativity has been pretty bulletproof for the past since he made it up. I mean, it's really been tough to find a real weakness in that theory, and a lot of people are testing and trying, but have yet to actually to break it. So, breaking Einstein's theory of relativity might be the you know, a sort of foolhardy endeavor.
Published
as well.
1915, I think, was the date. Let's move on to self-driving cars. We've seen advances in healthcare, quantum computing, but as we heard from Max Tegmark's clip earlier, what about those self-driving cars? Are they 20, 30 years away? Or are they a lot closer?
I'm looking forward to this because, I mean, humans aren't very good at driving cars. We've only been doing it for, like, you know, about a century. There are many, many traffic accidents that cause fatalities or injuries every single year. And the really big idea behind self-driving cars is that it could eliminate traffic fatalities and injuries, which would be phenomenal. And there have been some important progress points made this year. There are major companies invested in this on the car side and on the technology side. So you have Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, also running a company called Waymo that's invested in self-driving cars. They've actually said that they're going to skip level 3 autonomy, which is the level at which Tesla and Audi are currently operating, and that requires somebody to be in the driver's seat ready to take over the car if something goes awry. Waymo plans to skip that and go straight to level 4 driving autonomy, in which you do not need a human sitting in the car. They're actually programmed well enough that they're able to navigate in certain weather conditions and in certain pretty much urban environments on their own. And they're hoping to launch this in the Phoenix area in early 2018. So these are pretty big milestones. There's a lot of money being put into this. The technology on the car itself, the cameras, the LiDAR, they're all getting better. And, you know, there are projections for 2040 to 2100 to actually have level 5 self-driving cars, which is the thing we all dream about. Any road, any conditions, any urban or rural area, the car can just, you know, handle everything on its own. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm hopeful and confident that these companies will be able to figure this challenge out and actually improve public safety quite a bit.
But you have also, there are ethical questions, and there's even software ethical questions, Rachel, right? I mean, the car's got to hit somebody. If it's gonna, how does it decide whether you're going to be the one in the car that's going to get hurt or the pedestrian?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people talk about, like, you know, how should self-driving AIs deal with the trolley problem? You know, do you hit one person, hit 5 people, swerve them to hit somebody who wasn't even on the road at the time? But I kind of think that, like, self-driving cars themselves are kind of like a broader trolley problem. I hate philosophy, I'm sorry. But I think people assume this level of risk when they get into a car and drive it and feel like they're in control of that risk because they're the ones driving. And if we have these self-driving cars, the question is, will we accept any number of accidents from self-driving cars, or will we, you know, think that that's an unacceptable risk because this is a software that some corporation created and said was going to be safe? So I think that question of, you know, whether people are willing to hand over that assumed risk to an AI is a really big hurdle to actually getting these things adopted.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And let's wrap things up and let's talk about what else do you want us to remember for 2017 that we haven't talked about. Let me just ask you, Rachel, first. What other things happened?
Mm-hmm. So one thing that really sticks out for me, not exactly a hugely important study, but some researchers decided to – they were trying to figure out if, like, the total annihilation of life on Earth was possible. And, you know, it's not a perfect study, but based on all their calculations, tardigrades, otherwise known as water bears, or my personal favorite, moss piglets, would survive an event that would wipe out all other life on Earth. And personally, I find that very comforting. I think moss piglets would leave our planet better than they found it. So
at least you know it's not a cockroach that's going to survive us. It's going to be a tardigrade. Amy?
I just can't figure out if that was a happy story or a sad story. I love that.
Good thing, bad thing.
Well, one thing a story I'm interested in following certainly into 2018 is this massive hunt for Planet Nine. So finding this ninth planet in our solar system. And there was hope that that might have occurred in 2017. It has not yet been confirmed, but there are enough lines of inquiry that point to and suggest that this planet exists that astronomers are honing in on it using both classical techniques with telescopes and also software techniques, actually doing the computational work to mine old images. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to keeping my eye on that story next year as well.
We had a major astronomer on about that, talking about that, and I think he credited us with inspiring him to continue with the research. In fact, we got a little mention in a research paper.
That's fantastic.
To continue on looking for planet, I always want to think of the movie, Planet Nine from Outer Space, every time I say that, but that's another story. Ryan, give us your pick.
Yeah, I mean, so for next year, I will be keeping my eye on quantum computing, but I think that a story this year I thought was really cool was scientists discovered five new Homo sapiens specimens that were pretty far away from the traditional spot in Africa where people sort of peg our origin at. And they were dated some 100,000 years earlier than the origin of humanity. So, I mean, humans have been around probably longer than we think. So I thought that was really amazing.
A lot of stuff to look forward to. Follow up on 2018. I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer at Gizmodo. Amy Nordstrom, news editor for IEEE Spectrum. Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. We'll see you all in the new year. Oh, and one last thing before we go. Did you know that Google backs up your emails on magnetic tape? And that librarians are hard at work saving web pages on the internet? You may think that your photos on Facebook or your tweets will last forever, but your data is actually not quite that permanent. These are just some of the digital dilemmas covered in our new File Not Found series, a three-part look at the ways data can be lost in a digital dark age, and how researchers and archivists are battling to preserve it for the future. Check it out. It's up on our website right now at sciencefriday.com/data. That's sciencefriday.com/data. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. We had technical and engineering help today and all year from Rich Kim, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz. And we are active all week on Facebook, Twitter, Instagrams, all social media. And you can ask Amazon Echo and Google to, well, I won't say the words because they'll all turn on, if you want to listen to Science Friday whenever you'd like to, because every day now is Science Friday. Have a great and happy new year. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.